Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and I'm going to begin with my ginger snack. These are scientific articles or relevant materials that come across all of our desks here in the office, me and Ginger and our assistant, and that to get our attention and that we think would be of interest to you. Three very interesting things this week. One, a column in the Wall Street Journal. Haven't yet been able to get a hold of the article, but Journal describes research carried out in two schools in the U.S., in Indiana and Vermont, where of all things, they took a group, a couple of hundred kids with ADHD symptoms, boys, and they gave them a half hour of exercise before class, before school started. And they had a control group of similar kids, and they gave them a half an hour of classroom work before school. Now, are you shocked to hear that these kids weren't so out of control? That they actually had better attention during the day with a little bit of a half hour of exercise? That they their mood was better? Their concentration was better? Academic skills better? Well, you know, it's a little bit like saying, yeah, so we decided to give the kid breakfast, and by God, he had more energy. Exercise is food and body soul for children. And we've deprived them of it. And I'll bet the exercise also involves some involvement with adults to start the day. I doubt if they just threw the kids out on the playground and said, go exercise. So they probably had some relationship going on with a teacher or a coach. You know, it's wonderful to see science catch up with common sense, but the tragedy is that this is nothing that people haven't known for a long time who care about children, that one of their big problems they're facing today is in school. They don't get enough play time, enough exercise time, enough art time, enough music time, enough fun time. Well, I doubt very much whether the psychopharmaceutical industry now will devote itself to advocating for exercise for children, so somebody else is going to have to do it. And for those of us in the health professions and who are interested in kids and in the teaching professions, we really have to advocate for kids having a normal childhood instead of drugs. And the avowed purpose here was to see if there were interventions that would work instead of drugs, and their belief and their results are, yes, half-hour exercise in the mornings for boys. Welcome to the world. Two studies are published by the International Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine. I'm proud to say I'm on their board. It's an international journal. I may be the only or maybe one of the few American psychiatrists on the board. It's come out with two articles that I did not review and that I had nothing to do with, but they are good articles. And they pertain to the potentially disastrous effects of SSRIs that actually have legal implications as well as health implications. One study by Louise Brookwell, 93 cases of alcohol dependence following SSRI treatment. So they looked at a number of countries in Europe that have mandatory reporting, at least many of them, like Great Britain, have mandatory reporting. And they found clear-cut cases of SSRI treatment producing alcohol dependence that was reversible when the SSRI was stopped, drinking would stop, Well, I have seen numerous criminal cases in which violence has been committed under the influence of SSRIs, and a complicating factor has been alcohol. I've tried to argue with mixed success that the alcohol in these cases was increased or even begun for the first time, or the first time in years, after the start of SSRI treatment. And this gives us one more good scientific basis. I hope some lawyers might even reopen some cases where violence was committed with SSRIs and alcohol, because we now have some more scientific basis for that, just like we have more scientific basis for the SSRIs causing violence from the studies by Thomas Moore and Joe Glenn Mullen of the database from the FDA showing a very striking pattern of violence from a number of psychiatric drugs and not from drugs in general. And then another one to deal with the SSRIs, 93 cases of alcohol dependence following SSRI treatment. This is by the same basic team. In fact, it's a very, very much the same team, with one exception. Again, involves Louise. No, it doesn't actually. Louise not involved in this one. This is a fellow named, or a person named Karis, K-A-R-Y-S, Hogan. Don't know him. Hogan. And it's again in the International Journal of Risk and Safety, and they're again looking at the database of reports from a number of European countries, 20 in all. And they're finding enduring cases of sexual dysfunction following SSRI treatment. It's a combination of impotence, loss of libido, feelings of anesthesia, and I think loss of loving feelings. So again, something that the medical profession does not want to face, thank goodness for the International Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine. Let me repeat something I can't say enough to the world and to my audience about psychiatric drugs. Very little proof that they help people. It's all short-term studies devised by the drug companies, carried out by their paid minions and dear friends in the research community. They're not really researchers. They're minions of the drug companies. The data then culled by the drug companies, the reports then written by the drug companies. That's how we get efficacious drugs, with these extraordinary billion-dollar corporations manipulating data. It's very little evidence for efficacy, even short-term, for psychiatric drugs. Virtually no evidence for long-term help from psychiatric drugs, and tons of evidence for multiple horrific long-term adverse effects from all psychiatric drugs. And once again, I review the data in my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, the first half reviews the data for why people shouldn't be taking psychiatric drugs, and the second half talks about the hazards of coming off these drugs and the need for care and support in doing so. You'll find in the book that I already am describing lasting sexual dysfunction from SSRIs, and I'm already describing alcoholism in association with the SSRIs. But here we now have increasing evidence for these findings. So that's the stuff of today, the mix of news from the world of mental health. God save us from our colleagues. Now for a wonderful colleague, Penelope Young Andrade. Penelope, are you there?
Yes.
You're listening to my ginger snaps?
I love it. Yes, I'm listening.
Penelope, I'm delighted to have her on my show again. And like a lot of my guests, Penelope is on our advisory council. Proud to have her as a supporter of our organization. She's written a really good book, Emotional Medicine RX. The subtitle is Cry When You're Sad, Stop When You're Done, Feel Good Fast. She is the founder of the San Diego that tells you where she is, lives in a nice climate, San Diego Center for Psychosynthesis. She has a popular advice column, Transformational Talk, that reaches thousands of readers in Southern California. Her work, she feels, draws on the most powerful elements of both traditional and alternative therapies to help people heal depression, anxiety, without medication. So she's one of those folks that takes a stand. She's a social worker, LCSW, takes a stand on doing it without medication. And her website is emotionalmedicinerx.com. And one thing I like about Penelope's work is she has specific suggestions that she finds useful and healing, and she'll get specific with us on the show and tell us her ways of going about helping. And I think there's a universal element to what she does. Where would you like to begin, Penelope?
Well, I'd like to begin by telling you and the listeners about an amazing experience I had in my therapy office about 3 weeks ago. I had a new client who came to see me, a 30-something woman with a terrible history, right out of Charles Dickens. I mean, abusive, terribly abusive childhood. And she made a point of telling me that one of the ways she survived her childhood was that she made a decision not to cry. That's how she was going to get through. She was going to steel herself, pull herself together, and she was not going to cry about the terrible abuse she suffered at the hands of her mother and a non-involved father. And we were doing our session, you know, getting to know each other. This is the first time we'd met each other. And about halfway through the session, she mentioned that within the last 2 weeks, her beloved dog had died. And as I was hearing her talk about this, I could tell that feelings were close to the surface, and so I gently made some musical, you know, sounds that we make when somebody's telling us something sad, like, oh, mm-hmm, I made these sounds, I let her know that I was there, we'd had a good connection. And she started sobbing, deep, full-body sobs. I was delighted inwardly. I mean, I wasn't delighted that she lost her dog. I was delighted that she was sobbing because I knew what's on the other side of any brief, embodied experience of sad, mad, scared energy, and that is feeling good. So she was sobbing 60 seconds, 90 seconds, maybe 2 minutes, and I'm always watching people's bodies, my own when I'm having an emotional experience, my clients when they're having any experience. I'm watching people's bodies to see, okay, what's happening right now in this moment in the body? That's my guide. So I noticed when her body was done with the grief. Now, the grief around losing a beloved, the only being in the world who'd been there for her through her horrific childhood was this dog. Now, the grief about that is not going to be over ultimately in one 90-second experience of deep sobbing. But for the moment, in the moment, the grief would be over in a minute or two. So I knew that, and I was watching her body to see when she would start signaling, the body would start signaling that she, that this wave, this big wave of emotion was done. And I noticed that her breathing eased. Her color in her face smoothed out. Her face got calmer. I noticed her muscles relaxing. And I called her attention to this in the session. Notice right now that you're breathing more easily. Notice that you seem to be more relaxed. What if we just, for a few moments now, tuned in? You've done a beautiful job of sobbing and grieving for this moment. Let's tune in now to what your body is feeling in this moment, this next moment. She was able to do that. She was able to tune in and feel that she was relaxing. And so as we explored that for another few minutes, what were the sensations that were feeling good, I said to her, what's it like now to have, how are you feeling right now? What's it like? She was silent for a few moments, and then she said, wow, I've been trying to figure out what this feels like. And you know what it feels like? This feels exactly how I feel after I take Xanax. A few minutes of sobbing and stopping when her body was done gave her an experience of the calm that she'd had to turn to drugs for.
That's exciting. That's interesting.
I was ecstatic. That's my book, Emotional Medicine RX. That's it.
Yes.
Right there. If, you know, now the tricky part of this is you have to know when you're sad. You have to be able to cry. You have to know when you're mad. You have to be able to safely and responsibly allow 60 seconds or a minute or two of discharge in your body. But at the end of it, and Peter, I've been a therapist for over 30 years, and I have never not seen work. That if you can cry when you're sad and stop when you're done, you are going to feel good fast. I have never not seen this work with anybody. This brings tears to my eyes. This touches my heart. The reason I have written my book, the reason I'm talking to you, is that I want people to know that we have this incredible medicine chest right in our own bodies, and we can access it. We can access it in such easy ways. I want people, you don't need Xanax. You can feel just that calm, just that strong in your ability to manage your life if you let yourself sob for a minute or two, as you would if you took a pharmaceutical. I want everybody in the world to know this.
I would go a step further and say that what she was feeling, if she got a little more used to it, is probably infinitely better than what she felt coming from the Xanax.
Absolutely.
And good. So I hope you'll work on that one with her. Because
I believe. Absolutely.
Oh, good.
I don't,
good.
Yeah. And I, of course, because we know that there's a numbing and a diminishing, like you said in your introduction, you know, shutting down the heart, the kinds of things that we have to shut down. And she, in the moment that she was with me, was not feeling shut down in her heart. She was feeling her full self, fully alive, all of her nervous system, all of her, you know, resources were available to her, and they're not when you take meds, not Xanax, and not only that, but they're, when you take meds, you got side effects, terrible side effects. So for me, though, I was happy that she, I mean,
yeah, right.
That she could make the, and oh, you know, here's what I forgot, here's the punchline, another punchline. This is, she said, this is just how I feel when I take Xanax, and she said, I can't believe I could do this myself. That's what she said after that. I can't believe I could do this myself. You know, because the pharmaceutical industry has us believing that we can't do anything on our own, that we have to take a drug for every single thing, that we don't have resources in our own bodies and our own brains and our own hearts and our own networks to help us move through the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune of life. And we do have those, as you know, as I know. So I was so excited that she got that, she knew. And I have to tell you, this person came, even though my reputation, I'm the person people come to when they want to handle anxiety and depression without medication. That's what I have on my website. That's what I have. It's my tagline. You know, this person came to me. She was already on an SSRI an anti-anxiety and a beta blocker. He was already on all of that, and still we could find enough life force for her to find some deep grief about her dog and feel better. So, you know, of course, I've worked with a number of people who come in, they're on meds, and I gently and, you know, as they're ready to let go and understand that they can function on their own. I help them do that. And I want everybody to know it's possible. And the other thing, I was so glad that you started off with the mention about exercise, because research-based evidence, 30 minutes a day of exercise is as good as any antidepressant, evidence-based. We know that. Now, the problem is, you know, if you and I could just sit here and say to anybody who called us up with the trouble, you know, you're going to feel a lot better if you just go out and exercise for 30 minutes. The problem is that we, with our empathic therapy, have to help people learn and love themselves enough to make the healthy choice to go out and exercise. That's where our work comes in, don't you think?
I think so. I think a lot of our work is coaching people to take care of themselves.
Yeah.
One way or another.
Right, but you know, if it was easy as just do it, you know, we wouldn't need anybody other than Dr. Laura, or we wouldn't need anybody just to say, oh, well, you know, just go out and exercise, and you'll be fine, you know. I don't need to see you again, or just make sure that your diet is balanced. I mean, exercise and nutrition, we understand that food and exercise affect the brain. They affect the brain. And I want people to know that emotions affect the brain in medicinal ways when you learn how to work with them. That's what I say. Emotions are medicine. And I'm not calling depression or anxiety or shame or guilt an emotion. I'm calling emotions only the six universally known emotions: sad, mad, scared, glad, surprised, disgust. These are the six emotions that everybody in the world has, that everybody's born with, that anybody in the world can recognize. And these, especially sad, mad, scared, actually I like to call sad, mad, scared, glad the four horsemen of the apothecary, because they result in such good results for human beings.
How did you arrive at your concept of dividing up emotions?
Of what?
Of define. How did you arrive at your list of key emotions?
Well, you know, that's based on the work of Paul Ekman. He's a neuroscientist. He's a facial recognition expert, and he took pictures of faces to all four corners of the globe back in the 60s, long ago, to see. This was before, you know, the internet, and before Facebook and Twitter and whatnot, to places where people didn't even have TV, and to see if there were some universal emotions. And so he discovered these were the universal emotions. And these, so I just, based on his research and based on my own experience.
What's his name again, Penelope?
Paul Ekman, E-K-M-A-N.
And it's sad, mad, glad, and...
Sad, mad, scared, glad, surprised, disgust.
Scared, surprised, disgust. Okay.
These are the basics.
These he concluded were universal.
Yes. And most
of make them instinctual, really.
Yeah, they're instinctual. They're there. And they all lead to action. That's one of the ways that you know you're dealing with an emotion and not a state of mind, because anxiety is a state of mind. I mean, it's also a state of body, but anxiety doesn't move unless you work very... I mean, you can move anxiety. If you move anxiety, what you're going to find underneath anxiety is sad, mad, scared. That's what's underneath anxiety. Depression doesn't move. Anxiety doesn't move. Guilt doesn't move. automatically, sad, mad, scared, glad, surprised, disgust, they move. You know, the Latin word for emotion is emovere, to move out. And emotions are designed to lead us to take life-enhancing action. That's their function. The function of emotion is to get us to take life actions that will help us survive and thrive. And, I mean, Paul, excuse me?
Let me say, the way this fits with my own thinking that will be coming out in my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, in December, is that guilt, shame, and anxiety are what I call negative emotions. They all paralyze action.
Immobilizing.
And you're contrasting them with this array of emotions as motivating people to take positive actions.
Absolutely. But I'm a little fussier, Peter. I don't like to call, and I suppose we could make a difference here between primary, instinctual, and secondary, and many in neuroscience do make that distinction, and they would consider guilt or anxiety a secondary emotion. I don't like to call those things emotions. I don't like to call depression an emotion or anxiety or guilt an emotion. I like to call those states of mind. And because I like to reserve the word emotion, and, you know, we can call it primary. Primary emotions, they are healthy. They're good for you. They're medicine. They're going to lead you to feeling better fast in a couple of minutes, and they're going to lead you to take healthy action in your life.
Yeah, I call them negative legacy emotions. It basically is saying something similar to what you are.
Yeah,
I call guilt, shame, and anxiety are negative legacy emotions that afflict us in order to keep us from expressing our darker side, basically. You know, we are very loving creatures, but we're also very destructive creatures.
Yes,
and I view guilt, shame, and anxiety as built-in legacies to prevent us from our more willful and violent side, but they don't work very well because they're very primitive.
Right.
They don't really relate to what we need, which is to be guided by positive emotions.
Right.
It's interesting, and I talk of positive emotions mostly in terms of love, treasuring, valuing, and so on. And you have it, and you and Paul Ekman have a somewhat different take. It's all very interesting.
Right.
Very
Here's what I've discovered about anger. And, you know, anger to me is brief, embodied, responsible experience of anger. And I'm not talking resentment, state of mind, revenge, state of mind. Anger itself does not, the body, when it's angry, does not need to actually punch a person or kill a person. The body needs maybe the fists need to move, but the body's just as happy with punching a pillow for a moment as it is for punching a real person. It's the mind. It's the mind and the stories and I got to get revenge and all of that. If you can allow yourself a moment, you know, 60 seconds of really knowing I'm angry, of letting a growl. This is, you know, you do this in your bedroom, you do this in your parked car, you do it in your bathroom. A growl, letting yourself, you know, shake your fist, letting the anger move, because the energy of anger wants to move, like all of it wants to move, what you end up with is a loving heart. I have had a mantra that I used many, many years in my life, and that is, anger, my anger is a direct route to vitality, clarity, and love. And I didn't mean my revenge or my dumping anger on people. I meant my experience, allowing myself my experience of anger would allow me to open my heart and feel real love and feel real clarity. Now, again, it's all tricky because you have to be sure you're not dumping anger on another person. You know, your mind wants to dump it on another person. Your body just wants to express it, might want to shout, might want to kick. Briefly, and the body's done, and then how you feel is good.
Penelope, we're coming to the half hour, And I'm talking with Penelope Young Andrade, LCSW, from San Diego and author of Emotional Medicine RX. When we come back, I'm going to ask Penelope to talk about her therapy practice and whether it's completely focused on this kind of activity or whether there are other things that she does as a part of therapy. And I'm going to ask her, what's it like to advertise that she does therapy without drugs? Because there are therapists all over the world who are afraid to do that. They'll get in trouble. We'll be back in a few minutes with Penelope. They're talking on the air right now. It's Peter Bregan, back with overflowing with life and emotion and good things, marvelous Penelope Young Andrade, LCSW. You know, some of you out there are therapists, and some of you have been afraid to just say, I want to help people without drugs. And I want you to just think about how Penelope is doing this. And we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, about whether she's been endangered by taking this stance. How is she limited or not limited or protect herself? Does she ever suggest to people that drugs may not be good for them? So I'm going to sort of challenge her to do that in a few minutes. But first, I want to challenge her in response to the potential question of, okay, that's really good. You know, therapists should do that, but you're oversimplifying. There's much more to therapy and life than that. Would you pick up on that question?
Absolutely. And you're totally right that, you know, the prescription, cry when you're sad, stop when you're done, feel good fast, is really simple. Easy to say and hard to do. Because what we run into as therapists is we run into people who are numb, who cannot feel, who can't, you know, either that they're numb and they can't feel, or once they start feeling, they can't stop, they're up in their head. I mean, this is a very simple-minded prescription, you're right, and I wanted it to be that way. I put it right on the cover of my book. That's the prescription, and I want people to, you know, I want to help to begin to make a dent in this cultural prescription we have that everybody should apologize when they cry and that feelings are a problem. So that's true. It's simple-minded. Yes, when you have a client come into your therapy office, just to be able to get somebody to know that they're sad might take weeks or months of therapy. Just to get somebody, once they know that they're sad, to be able to tune into their bodies. People, if you've been traumatized, because the other factor that rears its ugly head here is trauma, post-traumatic stress. And trauma impacts every level of the emotional medicine prescription. Because if you've been traumatized, most likely, and you're still traumatized, most likely you're stuck in freeze mode. You're in this immobilization that you mentioned earlier, Peter, where the states of mind, shame, guilt, anxiety, or the states of mind of post-traumatic stress lead you to be immobilized. And if your client comes in and can't feel their body, or if you're a listener right now, and you are numb, you need to proceed with caution. I have a whole chapter in my book around denumbing, how carefully and gradually you need to go to be able to understand and feel safe having an embodied experience of any kind. So yes, definitely the emotional medicine prescription is simple. I want people to remember it, and easy to say and hard to do. Yeah, because it involves dropping into your body in the present moment and stopping for all of the barriers. I can't drop in my body. If you've been traumatized and you learn to survive by shutting down your experience in your body in the moment, you need to proceed with great caution, because safety, and this is where, you know, Peter, you call your work empathic therapy, and the movement is empathic therapy. And the first thing we do is establish an empathic bond. And you know what? Sometimes that's hard. People are not used to empathy. They don't trust it. you have to spend weeks or months moving through the people's fear or mistrust of an empathic rapport with a therapist. So very, very tricky at many, many levels. And still,
you do deal then with trauma. You go back and you will look with people at their traumatic experiences and try to help them experience them emotionally?
Yes, only with this very important caveat. Only if they are in their body, they're able to be comfortable in their body, A and B. Actually, it's just the reverse. A is yes, if they are able to feel an empathic connection with me, and B, if they're able to feel safe in their body. And the reason this is so important is if a person goes back and to review a traumatic experience and does not feel connected with you, it's like they're going back alone again. And part of the healing work is we undo aloneness. That's part of the healing work. And you might be surprised, Peter, of the number of times when you think somebody feels you and they don't. And you say, do you feel me here? And they say, well, actually, no. So, yes, go back and review the trauma. There's enormous healing potential there. And I say we don't review it as much as we redo it. We go back, somebody can feel safe with me and really feel connected with me so that at whatever level we touch a trauma, that person, the client, does not do it by themselves, that they're there being partnered. And that's a shift in itself. That'll start a healing process right there. The second important, crucial element is that they are able to feel comfortable in their body because the body does not need to stay traumatized. The body's looking for solutions to that trauma. Even the original freeze, you know, fight, flight, freeze are the ways that we handle traumatic experience, or instinctual responses. When we get stuck in a freeze mode and an immobilization mode, our body beneath that freeze is ready to restore us to full resourcefulness again. And what are we going to find under that freeze? We're going to find sad, mad, scared feeling. We're going to find the feelings of grief that came up with the original trauma. We're going to find the feelings of anger at the incident or the perpetrator, and we're going to find the feelings of fear and the place where the organism made a decision to either fight, flee, or freeze. And if you made a decision to freeze and that was the way you were going to survive, underneath that is going to be some place where your body would like to now run or fight. You know, they've done studies. People who are able to fight their way through somebody perpetrating, people in war, people in dangerous situations, if you could fight your way out, if you could run your way out, you are not as traumatized as if you had to freeze to survive. That's where human beings run into trouble. So,
I really, really like the way you put that you don't go back and look at trauma until basically the person feels that you're going to be there as an empathic companion.
Right.
That is it's a better way than I've been putting it to myself and my patients. I talk about that you can't go back and look at an experienced trauma if you're feeling helpless about it.
Right.
And that's true, too. But what you're saying is, I think, more helpful than the way I've been thinking about it, which is you can't go back alone. You
right.
want to go back with somebody who's you feel is present there with you to help you have that strength to
exactly.
not be overcome.
Exactly.
I love the way you talk about therapy. I just think you're doing you're doing a really good job of expressing it today.
I'm so glad. And let me say the other part about that. Yes, I totally agree with you. To go back and review a trauma when you're back feeling helpless, don't do it. You're just putting down another layer of trauma. So I think you're on the right track with that. And to know that having yourself there as a therapist, as a resource for that person, and that's why I also say if the person can tolerate their body, because the body if a person is feeling safe with you and they're safe within their body is going to have the strength right then. And that will bring huge amount of healing. And then you'll have a healing, you'll have healing, you can have healing images, you can have healing fantasies that come out of it, as long as you're feeling partnered and present in your body in the moment. So, yay.
You know, a lot of people feel that their body is almost their enemy, and they've even been convinced by psychiatry that their brain is their enemy.
Exactly.
You talk about that.
Oh, right. You and I and Ginger and all of the people in your network, just infuriates me. Ah, I'm going to shake my fist for a minute here. How the pharmaceutical industry has made people not feel that they have these innate patterns for healing and survival, even through the worst trauma, that they're helpless, that it's something wrong with their brain. I mean, I'll give it to you that some babies are born with greater sensitivity to stimulation than others, but not born with depression and SSRI deficiency. I'm sorry. And yes, if you're born with certain nervous system deficiencies, not deficiencies, certain tendencies toward being more sensitive to stimuli or having a more sensitive digestive system or whatever it is, you're going to have to learn to self-care and to be connected with yourself in a special way. But if you do that, if you watch what you eat, if you exercise, if you cry when you're sad and stop when you're, if you're supported to do that, you have resources. Everybody does. I have a client who I work with, a lot of brain injured people. The amount of resilience that we have in the brain, the amount of resources we have in the brain and in the body are just enormous. And to have the pharmaceutical industry convincing us, everybody, that there's something wrong with your brain, this is the first thing that we therapists have to do. And I'll get back to your other question now about, you know, my tagline is sad, mad, scared, glad, emotions are medicine. Heal anxiety and depression without drugs. That's me. And yes, sometimes when people come in, first session, and they're coming in with a lot of anxiety or depression, I will say to them, if I were a therapist oriented toward drugs, I would now refer you to a psychiatrist. But I am not. I am a person that people come to see if they want to handle these situations without medication, and I know how to do that. So I put the choice back on them. You know, I know how to help you. I had one gal come in, terrible anxiety, and there were some psychodynamic issues. She was moving in with a new partner. She was really apprehensive about that. But then I asked her, like, okay, well, tell me what you're eating. Well, she's having coffee, Diet Coke, and yogurt for most of the day. I said, I'm sorry, you're not going to be able to manage an anxiety disorder with coffee, Diet Coke, and yogurt and fruit. You know, go out and eat a hamburger. Or, you know, if they're a vegan, they're not going to eat a hamburger. I mean, vegans, actually, that's another whole area. But go out and have some salmon, have some brown rice, have some olive oil. These are things that are going to help you manage your anxiety. And then teaching her about the emotional medicine. And she said, well, she was going to try it. She was the medications, they tell her, don't kick in for 6 weeks. So I said, before you try the medication, consider. But, you know, I don't come on as strong in my therapy hours. I'm coming right now on the radio. You know, consider trying for 6 weeks, changing your diet, getting out of your head when you're scared and noticing what's happened in your body and see if there's some sad, mad, scared feelings there that you can move through. And she came back in 6 weeks, and she was fine. She was fine.
Penelope, I think a lot of therapists would be very afraid to say something like that. They would be scared that, oh, my gosh, the patient's going to go tell her psychiatrist, I've been told to wait, or the patient's going to go out and have a breakdown, go to a hospital, attempt suicide, and they'll come back after me. What about that? Because, I mean, a lot of folks are just really intimidated, a lot of potentially good therapists.
Well, you know, like I said, I don't, in the therapy hour, I do not come on as strong as I come on when I'm out on the bandwagon for let's heal this stuff without meds. So in this, I put it on her. I say, if you want me to refer you for a psychiatric interview, I'll do that. It's up to you. But I know how to do this without. You choose. Do you want to try doing it without?
Good for you. And I'll bet you have never been, I bet you've never been in any serious legal trouble about that, have you?
No. No.
Well, listen, I want therapists out there, people who are thinking about being therapists, to listen. Because if you have a caring relationship with your client and you're offering them genuine help, even if they don't think they get helped, they're not going to turn on you. And that you are safe. The people who are getting sued are the people giving the drugs. That's why prescribers have very high insurance rates and therapists don't.
Mm.
It's extraordinarily unusual for therapists to get into any kind of trouble for being critical or hesitant about drugs or for offering a different service or for educating people about drugs or giving people one of my books or somebody else's books to read about drugs. And I'm just so glad to have you as an example, Penelope, as somebody who is just thriving and enjoying her practice and enjoying her life, who isn't cowering in fear of the psychiatrist and the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, I'm not. And part of the reason I'm not is because of you. Because of
nice.
Yeah, truly. That touches my heart, Peter, and that brings tears to my eyes. What it's meant for me to have your books and your presence, you and Ginger, out there holding this line for us all. All of us who want to offer this alternative. And like, I don't know if I would go so far as to say that I feel that even if I was loving and caring, a person might not turn on me because the unconscious is something.
And that's true.
And the unconscious could see me and could find my caring to be, really.
Oh, I 100% agree with you.
Yeah, so I don't feel safe in that somebody wouldn't turn on me because I'm loving and caring toward them.
No.
I do feel like I offer it as an alternative, and I do have a psychiatrist colleague that is a loving guy that if person insists, I will make a referral. I mean, I say, I know how to do this without. I offer choices. So I don't say, and if somebody asked me what I would do, I would say, well, I wouldn't do it. And if somebody asked me if they have a choice, a new client the other day, she had just gotten her medication.
I think we may have lost you. I don't know. Am I on the air? I'm on the air, but we've lost Penelope Young Andrade, LCSW. We still have 6 minutes left. She may come back, I hope. I really want Penelope to be an inspiration for all of you out there who are being therapists and thinking about maybe you could be a therapist. You don't have to live under the shadow of the psychopharmaceutical cloud. It's not a shadow, it's a toxic cloud. There is life. There is... All right, we're going to have some excitement here. See, I sit here at my Skype, and I'm talking with my person who's on the air with me, my interviewee, and they have phoned in separately. Are you back, Penelope?
Yes, I got so excited I dropped the phone, and then that must have broken the connection.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
We've had a lot of excitement here. We've had operators and all kinds of activity. They may edit it out of the show, or they may not. I don't mind if they leave it all in.
Okay.
So, Penelope, you've got 5 minutes. We've got about 5 minutes left. I was just telling people how really glad I am for you and for what you're doing. And thank you for the very, very nice support for me and Ginger and what we're doing.
Oh, it's so important. Oh, my gosh. Oh.
Folks, you're not alone out there.
That's right.
Folks in our audience, you're just not alone. Oh, and by the way, we do have an upcoming conference in October. It's coming up here in Syracuse, New York. It's a joint conference that I'm holding with Michael Gilbert, who has his own nonprofit. Let me give you a little info. I just thought of it, so let me pull out my info here. The conference is on Wednesday, October 29th, and Thursday, October 30th. I'll be there both days, and I'll be emceeing October 30th. And we've got a lot of great people there, in addition to Michael and myself, including Bob Whitaker, who's going to be talking on both days. You can look this up by looking up Michael Gilbert's It's All About Family. And you can also find it on our website and on empathictherapy.org. And it's going to be a great conference.
I want to say that if anybody has not heard you in person, it is so worth it. It is so inspiring. My husband and I went. I presented at your conference in Buffalo? What was that town?
Buffalo.
Wasn't Buffalo. Where was it? Schenectady?
Anyway,
near where you live.
I think you may have been in Syracuse.
Syracuse. Okay. Sorry, New Yorkers.
And we're holding this one again in Syracuse.
Yeah, okay. Well, it was just a total pleasure to hear you and to be around people who share the same values. And because, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has such a huge grip on the airwaves and on the medical profession, to be in a place where people of like minds who really value human resourcefulness and human integrity and empathy and love, you know, to really recharge your batteries. It's a wonderful experience. I highly recommend it.
These conferences do inspire people, and you get to meet people that you might make lifelong friends with. I always meet people. I met Penelope at one of my conferences.
Yeah, exactly.
And her husband, who are just amazing to have a dinner with. They make a dinner unforgettable with their humor, and they're just incredibly full of life, as you can tell. And I am very different at the conferences than on the air, because I do present my own views for an hour. You know, I'll do that on both days. I'll be talking for at least an hour on both days, and I'll be on a panel. Whereas for my radio shows, for whatever reason, I'm happiest and most comfortable drawing out other people on my radio shows. I can't even tell you why, folks, but it's what I really love to do on the radio. And I actually get a little shy and uncomfortable when I think about doing an hour, whereas maybe because I can't see you,
mm-hmm.
maybe because I can't see mm-hmm. my audience. But so I want to relate to somebody. But, you know, it'll be a different experience if you haven't heard me talk.
And worth it. And never got boring and could have heard more.
Thank you.
Our experience. Both my husband, who is not a health professional, he was a criminal justice, but he and I both thought it was just wonderful. So I highly encourage everybody.
Hey, well, thank you. I hadn't thought about ending on that note. So come to the conference, look it up, go to empathictherapy.org. Thank you, Penelope.
And everybody go to my website, emotionalmedicinerx.com. Check out my book. And there's some free downloads on that website, too, for denumbing, for being present in the moment. Love to share this work.
And we are out of here.
Bye-bye,
folks.